This is a special report from NPR News, Summer of Racial Reckoning. I'm Elsa Chang. The deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, along with the ensuing protests, are forcing Americans to confront centuries of racism and oppression that continue today. The question facing all Americans is, how does this country reckon with its history of racism and move forward? Part of that means confronting the symbols of racism that are such a big part of American identity, like the Confederate flag, statues memorializing the Confederacy that were built decades after the Civil War during the Jim Crow era. Some of those symbols are coming down. And in some instances, people are fighting to hang on to them. NPR's Ari Shapiro took a closer look at one very prominent example of these statues, the enormous statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee in Richmond, Virginia.
Joining us now to talk about the history of these controversial symbols is Michael Paul Williams, columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch newspaper. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
To start with, this Robert E. Lee statue is the largest of the statues on Richmond's Monument Avenue. It was erected in 1890 after Reconstruction. Can you just describe the symbolism behind the statue then and now?
Well, put yourself in the shoes of a newly emancipated Black person in Richmond, some 25 years after emancipation, and you see this massive monument going up. It's hard not to imagine that those individuals are not filled with terror at what they were witnessing. It sent a clear message.
And what would you say it stands for today?
I think it stands for pretty much the same message it stood for in 1890. It's white supremacy.
As somebody who's been writing about and pushing for this for years, does this moment that we are in now feel inevitable to you, or does it feel like something that you thought might never come?
It kind of feels like a dream. You wonder if it's really happening. For so long, people did not listen. For so long, people were unmoved. And then something horrible happens in a city a half a continent away, and everyone's moving, and everyone's feeling what you felt.
Could you speak to a listener who might not have thought deeply about this and might think, why remove the history? The statue's been there for decades. Why tear it down?
You tear it down because it should not have been there in the first place. I would challenge that person to cite any example anywhere in the globe where a nascent nation rose up in opposition to the existing one with soldiers who were sworn to be U.S. soldiers, effectively committing treason, turning against their oath, killing U.S. soldiers, all in defense of enslavement of Black human beings. And then, 25 years after the war, when you would think the issue is settled, and by the way, against the advice of General Robert E. Lee, who did not want monuments, they erect these statues to not so much tell history, it's not history, but to erect massive bronze and granite statues of propaganda to effectively try to gaslight us into believing this was something other than what we all knew it was, which was a war to defend the right to enslave. The symbolism has bled into reality, and they've done wonders to help perpetuate the white supremacy that continues to plague this nation and manifest itself in the death of George Floyd. If this nation's ever going to be whole, if it's ever going to heal, you've got to get rid of this cancer. And these monuments are a cancer in America's body politic.
Do you have a vision of what would take the place of these monuments to the Confederacy on these now empty pedestals?
They could be monuments to reconciliation. They could be monuments to the African-American struggle, which until recent years was not told in statuary. They could be visions of where we want to be instead of celebrations of what we never should have been.
Michael Paul Williams is a columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
America's monuments to oppression are not limited to the Confederacy. They go back further and lionize the Spanish conquest and its legacy of violence, theft, erasing of indigenous culture, and forcible religious conversion. NPR's Lulu Garcia-Navarro explored the history and legacy of those monuments.
Statues of those conquistadors like Ponce de León and Juan de Oñate have been defaced or taken down in several states, including New Mexico, California, and Florida. This has fueled a larger debate within the Latino community over their colonial heritage and its place in modern America. Louis Dean Valencia Garcia joins me now. He's an assistant professor of digital history at Texas State, specializing in Spain and its global relationships. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
First of all, help us understand, how did these statues get put up in the first place?
Well, as the United States was changing its borders throughout the 19th century, the idea of who counted as American was changing. And so a lot of the colonial statues that we see of Christopher Columbus, of Isabel, of Ponce de León, all these people, really comes from this idea that there were people that were not being accepted as Americans in the 19th century, and they tried to lay claim to that through these statues.
Well, there's also been pushback, right, in the Hispanic and Latino community against taking these statues down. Recently, Cuban writer Fabiola Santiago in the Miami Herald wrote an op-ed titled, "We Don't Need to Erase Florida's Spanish Heritage to Fight Modern-Day Racism." Can you explain a little bit about that argument?
Yeah, I think that it's trying to think about what it is in our history that we want to celebrate. And I think one part of this is actually a representation of the lack of integration of Latino Hispanic history in elementary and high school curriculums. So Latinos and Hispanic identifying people are descendants of indigenous and European people. They are of colonizers and of the colonized. And this is also true for many Black Americans.
But some of this really does go back to the larger tensions within the Latino community. You know, white Hispanics who come from Spain or have lineage to Spain might see these statues differently.
And it's an opportunity for the Hispanic and Latino identifying people in the United States to have these hard discussions about race that have been subsumed for centuries. We need to talk about what white supremacy is. We need to talk about colorism. We need to talk about all of this within our communities and be aware of where it's coming from. So I don't think that this is a moment where we should hold steady to our statues. It's a moment that we can actually reflect a little bit more. A good metaphor would be, you might see a lot of statues in a Catholic church, right? But imagine if you were to see a statue to Satan and a statue to Judas Iscariot. No doubt those two figures are important figures in the history of Christianity. But the figures that we put onto pedestals are supposed to tell us something about our values. And I think anybody who would walk into a Christian church and see a statue of Judas Iscariot and of Satan would probably rightfully question the sort of ethics of that.
Louis Dean Valencia Garcia is assistant professor of digital history at Texas State University. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro. The Confederate flag is one of the most ubiquitous and prominent symbols of white oppression of American blacks, and it has appeared on the Mississippi state flag for generations, but it won't for much longer. White lawmakers in Mississippi had long resisted calls to change it, but finally, late in June, the state legislature voted to make a change. NPR's Steve Inskeep spoke to a state senator the morning after the vote.
Senate Minority Leader Derek Simmons is among the lawmakers who voted for the change and is on the line. Senator, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me.
I just want to note, I'm doing the math here. So this is a flag from 1894, I guess, more than a generation after the Civil War. But it is a kind of combination of the two main Confederate flags from that war. Was there ever any doubt in your mind about what that flag stood for?
It was never any doubt in my mind. It was a very hateful, oppressive, and divisive symbol. And after 126 years of flying that flag in the state of Mississippi, Mississippi will soon have a new flag.
I don't mean to recount the arguments you must have had all your life about this flag, but what did you say when people would push back and say, oh no, this is just a symbol of our heritage?
I said it was a symbol of hate and not love, and it was a symbol of division. and not unity. And I made it clear to people that it certainly was a flag that represented some Mississippians and not all. And so I had my own personal experiences regarding discrimination, and had my father and grandfather that shared many of their experiences, and how the flag was just a constant reminder that communities of color or Black Americans in Mississippi was just still not part of Mississippi.
What do you mean by a constant reminder? Would you be driving somewhere and see that flag? And well, what would go through your mind?
Yes, I actually the flag was in the schools that I was educated in. The flag was flying in the businesses that I would frequent. The flag was actually flying in public spaces for the entire 8 years of my legislative career. I've had to walk into the Capitol and not only see the flag outside of the Capitol, but every morning we would do invocation and we would do a prayer. And behind us, we'll have the American flag and, unfortunately, that Confederate flag.
Why do you think that this has changed now?
There is a combination of issues, Steve. Certainly what is going on nationally is the impetus. You have people wanting to address the inevitable, the racial inequality in America. These systems have basically been at the underlying conditions of a lot of the problems that we are seeing. In Mississippi, of course, that while the flag was just a symbol, the symbol is still like a symptom of the overall racial inequality that exists specifically in Mississippi. And so, I mean, I hope that this momentum continues in the state of Mississippi. And this is just the start of a new chapter in Mississippi so that we can have a more bright, progressive, and inclusive Mississippi. So let's take this flag down, but let's also address all the other issues that we face in Mississippi.
State Senator Derek Simmons of Mississippi, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Steve.
Coming up after a short break, what does it mean to defund the police? We'll hear from the activists and from the police. Stay with us. This is a special report from NPR News, Summer of Racial Reckoning. I'm Elsa Chang. Over the past several weeks, more and more Americans have begun to examine the relationship between police and the Black community. George Floyd was not the first Black person to die in police custody. There have been many more, including Michael Brown.
We lost a young man, Michael Brown, in heartbreaking and tragic circumstances. He was 18 years old. His family will never hold Michael in their arms again.
Brown was shot and killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri in the summer of 2014. After Brown's death, President Obama established a task force to look at police reform. The group's recommendations were adopted by many police departments across the country. But the number of Americans killed by police each year is still at about 1,000. Annually. That's according to data compiled by the Washington Post. George Floyd and Michael Brown are names on a very, very long list. And that list is part of a centuries-old history of Black Americans dying at the hands of police. Rund Abdel Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei of NPR's history podcast Throughline set out to learn the origins of policing in America, and they started in the South.
In this country, for the years that cover the 1600s to the mid-19th century, the most dominant presence of law enforcement was what we call today slave patrols. That's what made up policing.
This is Khalil Gibran Muhammad, a historian at the Harvard Kennedy School.
And perhaps the most revealing aspect of the way slave patrols functioned is that they were explicit in their design to empower the entire white population with the duty to police movements of Black people. So the tying together early on, the surveillance, the deputization essentially of all white men to be police officers, or in this case, slave patrollers, and then to dispense corporal punishment on the scene are all baked in from the very beginning.
These Southern slave patrols were eventually disbanded after the Confederacy lost the Civil War. But the violent control of newly free Black citizens continued.
A number of Confederate states began to pass these mega bills, these crime bills that we call today Black Codes. And they try to cover just about everything they would need to maintain absolute control over Black folks as quote unquote freedmen and freed women. But the 13th Amendment abolished slavery except as punishment for crime. So in some ways, the genius of the former Confederate states was to say, oh, well, if all we need to do is make them criminals and they can be put back in slavery, well, then that's what we'll do. And that's exactly what the Black Code set out to do.
The South was slow to formalize policing. So in the decades following the Civil War, these codes were enforced by vigilante groups like the Ku Klux Klan. This is partly what sparked the Great Migration, when millions of Southern Blacks went north in search of better and safer lives. But what very few of these migrants could have known was that Northern cities had been developing their own professional police forces.
And part of the context for early modern policing was that the immigrant population of Europeans, particularly the Irish, were generating a similar kind of social anxiety, xenophobic, nativist, racist reaction. The early emphasis on people whose status was just a tiny notch better than the folks who they were focused on policing. And so the Anglo-Saxons are policing the Irish are policing the Poles. And so this dynamic that's playing out is that police officers are a critical feature of establishing a racial hierarchy, even among white people.
This is the system Southern Black migrants were met with when they arrived in northern cities, where they quickly learned they were no safer up north than they were down south.
When a white person throws a Molotov cocktail into a new Black homeowner on a street that had previously been all Irish or all Polish or all German, the police come and they arrest the Black family and defend the white mob. This happens over and over again. They are policing the racial norms of white supremacy from the very beginning in the North. And so what do these Black folks do who are observing all this? They begin to write about it. W.E.B. Du Bois is writing for the NAACP magazine. He has essentially a police blotter, which systematically details all the examples of police brutality directed against African Americans everywhere. The National Urban League begins to do systematic survey research, and they overwhelmingly see that police officers are doing essentially stop and frisk policing in the 1920s. Other researchers looked at this all over the country and began to come to the same conclusion that these big cities had a systemic, massive policing problem. The thing about police that's just as so blatant is that they are the most visible representation of the state in most people's lives, especially for Black people. So, for example, in 1935, one of the leading Black sociologists publishes a really poignant statement about what police officers represent to the Black community. He says, "Too often the policeman's club is the only instrument of the law with which the Negro comes into contact. This engenders in him a distrust and resentful attitude toward all public authorities and law officers." He's saying, look, police officers are directly responsible for telling Black people how much their lives don't matter in this society. The irony about police professionalization that is occurring by the 1930s and will carry us into the 21st century is that part of police science begins to draw on crime statistics and sociological research about the innate or cultural tendencies of Black people to criminality, which then legitimate racist notions of Black people as a race of criminals. part of this professionalization is to say, those are the only real criminals we have to worry about. And so the question that has to be asked in the wake of George Floyd, and I think this question is being asked and answered by more white people than I've seen in my lifetime, is, do white people in America still want the police to protect their interests over the rights and dignity and lives of Black and, in too many cases, brown, indigenous, and Asian populations in this country?
That was Khalil Gibran Muhammad speaking with the hosts of NPR's Throughline podcast, Rund Abdel Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei. One rallying cry following George Floyd's death was to defund the police, and there have been calls from some to abolish the police altogether. That's put pressure on political leaders around the country to rethink what public safety could look like in their cities. One of them is Jillian Johnson, the mayor pro tem of Durham, North Carolina, who spoke to NPR's Michelle Martin.
Mayor pro tem Johnson, welcome. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
We're seeing this conversation being had in city councils in New York and in Los Angeles. So we're starting to hear this a lot, and not just with sort of street activists, but also people who have elected positions. So how did you first start thinking about this issue in this way? What kind of got you on this path?
Sure. So I'm an organizer by training and background, and have worked a lot with the issues around policing, around incarceration. And so coming into office, I was really interested in thinking about ways that we could transform policing in our community, focus on community safety, and figure out ways that we can build for a safer community and a healthier community without always relying on policing.
So when you talk about defund, are you talking about just scrapping the police department entirely? Or what do you have in mind when you say that?
Yeah, I think that there are certainly some people who want to completely get rid of police departments and start from scratch with something new. It's difficult to go immediately from what we have now to nothing, because we've told our residents for years and years that whenever anything goes wrong, the answer is to call the police. So I really think about it as building up alternative systems for providing community safety and transferring the resources that we have invested into policing into those systems so that our communities are always being taken care of.
I do understand from reading about you and your work that the department in Durham has embraced certain reforms in recent years, implementing body cams, for example, requiring a written consent for search. Part of the reason I raise that is that there are those who would argue what we really need here is reform, not a radical restructuring. That if more departments actually did the kinds of things that Durham has done, then you wouldn't need to rethink the whole thing. What would you say about that?
I think that the reforms that we've made in Durham have been really substantial and very important. And our police department has been very receptive to them. Our new police chief has been an advocate of reform. I think, though, ultimately, this is a system that was not created or designed to serve communities, especially Black communities. Our best chance for building a safety solution that puts people first, that puts communities first, that takes care of people rather than criminalizes, incarcerates, and punishes them, is by shifting resources that we use for policing into other systems, alternative institutions, rather than the institutions that we know are also causing us harm.
I know that when we were speaking before, you talked about the fact that do armed police really need to respond to a mental health crisis, for example? Give us a sense of what a different, less police-forward response to public safety could look like.
Sure, absolutely. Armed police do not need to respond to the majority of mental health crises. And in most cities, in Durham, this is certainly true, a significant number of our calls for police are actually these sort of crisis calls, you know, mental health calls or calls that really just need someone to de-escalate a situation. And so sending an armed police officer into that situation can actually escalate the conflict. Moving resources into that sort of crisis response team is definitely a goal that I have for my community. There's lots of work that police officers do that, in my opinion, does not require someone to be armed and authorized to use deadly force. I think that there are a lot of jobs, a lot of social work that we have assigned to police departments just for lack of alternative systems. And I think it's past time that we start building up those systems so that we have institutions in place that don't expose people to the risk of violence, that don't expose people to the risk of incarceration.
Just in the years that I've been covering this, I've just observed that when you talk about these issues, sometimes it just evokes this furious reaction, even if raising the idea of directing resources elsewhere or having a response to public safety that isn't so police-centric. Has that been your experience, and why do you think that is?
That has definitely been my experience. It's just one of those hot-button political issues that gets people really caught up in tense emotions. I think like the reason it evokes such a strong reaction is that it really forces people to deal with some of the roots of our country that we don't like to look at. The fact that police were established as a white supremacist institution, that they were created to police Black people and protect white property. There's a lot of history there that I think people don't know, don't want to know, don't want to look at, don't want to accept. You know, a lot of folks just aren't ready to deal with how damaging this institution is, how dangerous it is for people of color. White folks are taught to trust the police, that the police are their friend, that the police are there to help them. And Black folks largely are not taught that. And it's a very significant disconnect, I think. You know, people kind of exist in two different worlds with regards to how they think about policing. Those ideas and those feelings are just really deep-rooted. And when they're challenged, it causes a lot of anger, a lot of emotional angst for people.
Jillian Johnson is Mayor Pro Tem in Durham, North Carolina. Madam Mayor Pro Tem, thank you so much for speaking with us. I hope we'll talk again.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The pressure to change policing in America reached Capitol Hill in June. House Democrats passed a police reform bill while Senate Republicans turned to their only Black member, Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, to draft their bill. Congressional efforts stalled, but before that happened, I spoke with Senator Scott, and what struck me most was what he had to say about his own experiences with police.
Well, you typically never forget them because they're demeaning and by nature, and they are they kind of scar your soul a little bit at a time. And so I would just say that 7 times I was stopped as an elected official before I became a senator was in 1 year was just a tough year because you want to be supportive of law enforcement, but when you feel targeted, it makes it harder to be supportive. I've had, thankfully, enough good experiences as well as the tough ones that I can actually be supportive of law enforcement. I would say that this year I was pulled over by an officer who said that I used my turn signal late in my lane change. Now, I'm not sure that's a thing or not, but I was pulled over for that. And talking to some of the police chiefs that I know after that incident, they tell me that that's one of the tactics that have often been used to take a look in the car, take a whiff in the air. And it's just it's just tough to think of yourself as a target for just driving while Black. And it's one of the reasons why when I was on county council, I brought attention to it. When I was in Congress, I talked about it. And now as a senator, I've done several speeches on the importance of restoring trust in our institutions, which starts with the institution that has the power and the authority to execute harsh treatment.
If I may ask, was there something about that particular interaction you just mentioned when you got stopped for, I guess, using your turn signal too early? Was there something specific about what unfolded that made you feel you were indeed singled out because of your race?
Well, the officer was parked on the side of the road, so I saw him. So it's nearly impossible for me to not know that you're following every specific protocol is important. And I've done it before. And frankly, I've been stopped enough to make that judgment call, frankly. And I have other times when I was following a member of my team. We were going the same speed. The police pulled me over in my vehicle, let him go, and said that they thought maybe my vehicle was stolen. They didn't say that they pulled me over because I was black. They just stopped me for a reason that was crazy, because all you have to do is look up the license plate to figure out whose car it is. So if you find yourself on the wrong side of those stops often enough, you come to the conclusion that there must be something unique about yourself.
That was Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina speaking about his encounters with police. So where do we go from here? Coming up, we're going to hear from descendants of the freed slave Frederick Douglass and civil rights icons on what they see for the future. Stay with us. This is a special report from NPR News, Summer of Racial Reckoning. I'm Elsa Chang. George Floyd's death at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer and the protests that ensued throughout the country came after years and years of police brutality against Black people. This is far from the first time people have taken to the streets demanding change, and yet Black people have continued to be killed by white police officers as a system of racial injustice perpetuates. We started this series with a conversation with NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates from our podcast on race, Code Switch. She spoke with my co-host for this series, Rachel Martin.
Protests are still happening, right? There are still people on the streets in cities across the country.
Yes,
but
absolutely.
It's much quieter than it was in those early days after George Floyd's death. Congress has attempted to pass a federal police reform bill. It has failed in that effort. Does it still feel like we are at an inflection point?
Yeah, it still feels like everything's very unsettled, like things can still be negotiated. I think everything's just very up in the air. And the fact that this happened about 100 days before our next presidential election is, I think, making things harder, because I think people who might have been inclined to bend a little bit at either end, maybe aren't, because they're worried about how their constituents are going to receive that. And so it makes it harder to get anything done.
So, Karen, I think it's our natural tendency, human desire to always look for the hope, right? Look for the good. I want to play some tape of how a couple other people answered that same question. This is Karen Atia of The Washington Post and Jelani Cobb of The New Yorker. Let's listen.
I hesitate to answer that question. When people ask about hope or optimism, we sometimes think, in the American sense, that things will invariably get better. And there's a kind of fairy tale optimism that, you know, kind of cheap optimism. You know, it is entirely possible that this situation will remain as it is. It is entirely possible that the situation will get worse. You know, I hold to the possibility that things can get better, but by no means should we kind of rest on our laurels and assume that it automatically will.
You know, when I hear, you know, people looking to me like, but we're going to be okay, right? We're going to be fine. I ask who the we is, and I like, you know, James Baldwin's answers from way back in the day. You know, many of us in the Black community feel like we are waiting for white America to make its progress. And now so much of it is being caught on camera, is being seen, is being visible. Sure. So how do we turn that visibility into a more just and more fair and more democratic society. That is what requires constant work. And as long as people are willing to do that work, there is hope.
That was Karen Atiyah of The Washington Post and Jelani Cobb of The New Yorker. So, Karen, I mean, when you hear that, what do you make of what Karen Atiyah said? Are people willing to do that work?
I feel like, but it's just a sense, I don't know anything for sure, that this is different and that it feels as if people are going to be willing to hang in there for a longer period of time and that their expectations are that they will be changed and that it doesn't happen overnight and that it won't happen without everybody working on it. So take a chunk of this and move and do it.
So in all of that, I still sense some kind of hope in your voice.
I don't know. I'm a natural born cynic. That's my default mode. So it would be hard for me to give you an unqualified yes. But I will tell you that college friends of mine have often said over the years, God, we spent time in the streets. You know, we demonstrated for this. We were pushing for divestment in South Africa. We blah, 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 blah. And what are these kids doing? You know, they're making little videos and putting them online. And so our thought was, these children. But we were wrong because these kids are actually taking up the mantle and doing things. They're doing what John Lewis urged us all to do in his last op-ed. You know, they're getting in good trouble, necessary trouble. And I hope that continues because if we don't question the way things are, why is there any interest in having them change from the institutions that need to change? It won't be easy. It won't be fun. It'll be contentious along the way, I think. But what I hope is that people on all sides feel as if they have a stake in this, that as Benjamin Franklin said about signing the Declaration of Independence, or we hear he said this, you know, we all have to hang together or we'll hang separately if this thing doesn't work. I think if this thing doesn't work, this country is going to be in a lot of trouble. I would like for us to hang together. I would love for us to reach that point of beloved community that Dr. King and Congressman Lewis talked about and, you know, yearned for and worked toward. I don't frankly know that it's going to happen in my lifetime, but I would like to see us on the way to that. So that's as hopeful as I can get for you, Rachel.
Karen Grigsby Bates, senior correspondent for NPR's Code Switch podcast. Karen, thanks for talking with me.
You're welcome.
Veterans of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s do feel hopeful about this moment. Two of them, the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Josie Johnson, say the protests this summer are reminiscent of the protests that happened in 1968 after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Jackson worked with Martin Luther King Jr. and was with him when he was assassinated. Despite being diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, Jackson remains dedicated to the civil rights movement he's been part of for more than half a century. Johnson participated in the March on Washington in 1963 and was a representative from Minnesota then, where she has lived for most of her 89 years. They shared their thoughts with NPR's Steve Inskeep.
What do you think when people see an incident like the death of George Floyd and they say nothing has changed in America?
I have been involved in this struggle almost all of my life, since I was a teenager of 14. So to be here at this moment and observe a police officer whose attitude seems so careless and unconcerned. And if that young woman had not videotaped that experience, we would have heard the police once again indicate that George Floyd was trying to escape. Thank God. Now, what I'm concerned about is we've been engaged in police work ever since I can remember. We now have a police chief in Minneapolis who has declared his commitment to justice and equality. And obviously, that has not been heard.
You see white and black America rise up and fight back. You see people march in London and France. That's progress.
That is progress. And we've lived long enough to try to be hopeful again.
The marches are hopeful signs. The marches are full of hope. They believe something can happen.
That's right.
We're on the move. We're not going backwards.
And, Jesse, not only are we not going backwards, we must hold on to what we've learned and encourage, support, protect our children. We have got to help them make a difference so that the next generation, I think about my great-grandchildren, I've got three that I worry about. Are they going to grow up in an environment which they have to continue to struggle, as you, Jesse, have struggled, and I have struggled?
We dream without the right to vote. Now we dream with power. We must put in perspective. That's why violence must be challenged, because violence is a diversion. We're discussing burning cars as opposed to discussing police behavior. It is also a plot. The right wing will use violence to manipulate America's emotions. Dr. King was killed in 68. The first few days was a riot. People understood it. But then Nixon was able to turn the riots into a scare white people and elect himself on a law and order basis. We must not allow any element to invade our ranks. We believe in nonviolent direct action. We believe in voting. We're not going to give up. We're not going to stop.
You know, I'd like to ask, because you brought up 1968, a lot of people in recent days have compared the crisis the United States faces now to 1968. How do you compare 2020 to 1968?
Well, the fact that the reason why the police have not been killing blacks en masse is that we have a different quality of politician. If we had right-wing mayors, they would be turning the police loose to kill people. And there have been no killings. Because
I think you're telling me that there would have been a lot of dead people in these protests if the police tactics or the political leaders had been the tactics and leaders of 1968. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, in 1967, Dr. King did a rally in Houston, Texas. Aretha Franklin and Harry Belafonte hosted it. When Dr. King stepped on the stage to give Aretha Franklin flowers, they put tear gas in the fans. They had to evacuate the auditorium.
Yes.
Progress has been made. There is an attempt to turn the clock back. We're not going back.
It's not possible, given the history of oppression in America, for us to say, if we change the police, that's going to make it. It's systemic. It's everywhere. And so we need to educate and train and be encouraged that some of this may work with our police officers. But we also have to encourage, train, educate teachers, governors, mayors, council people. It's throughout the system. That's the pity of it. And we just need to keep on keeping on as a people, and not let our generation of young people now feel that it's not going to work. We've got to vote. We've got to get our people out there. They make a difference, and they know it. And we have got to hold on to the spirit and support of our young people, who are the you, Jesse, of 1960s. They can't let this happen again.
Well, Josie Johnson and Reverend Jesse Jackson, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
George Floyd's death and the protests his death inspired are a moment now in a long story that generations of Black Americans have become part of. We're going to close this hour by hearing from some of the members of a younger generation of Black Americans, descendants of Frederick Douglass.
I'm the great-great-great-granddaughter of Frederick Douglass.
Frederick Douglass is my great-great-great-great.
I've been counting on my fingers since I was like five.
I am the great-great-great-great-grandchild of Frederick Douglass.
NPR asked some of them to read Douglass's speech about the 4th of July.
This is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence and of your political freedom.
Fellow citizens, I shall not presume to dwell at length on the associations that cluster about this day. The simple story of it is that 76 years ago, the people of this country were British subjects.
Oppression makes a wise man mad. Your fathers were wise men, and if they did not go mad, they became restive under this treatment.
With brave men, there's always a remedy for oppression.
They succeeded, and today you reap the fruits of their success. The freedom gained is yours, and you, therefore, may properly celebrate this anniversary.
Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence?
Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us?
I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary.
Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common.
The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me.
The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me.
This 4th of July is yours, not mine.
You may rejoice. I must mourn. Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions.
At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument is needed.
Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke.
For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder.
We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake.
The feeling of the nation must be quickened.
The conscience of the nation must be roused.
The propriety of the nation must be startled.
The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed.
And its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim.
To him, your celebration is a sham.
Your boasted liberty an unholy license.
Your national greatness, swelling vanity.
Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless.
Your denunciations of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence.
Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery.
Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings.
With all your religious parade and solemnity are to him
mere bombast,
fraud,
deception,
impiety,
and hypocrisy. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. Allow me to say in conclusion, notwithstanding the dark picture I have this day presented of the state of the nation, I do not despair of this country. The 4th of July still doesn't mean that much. We're still second-class citizens. I don't think it's hopeless. Somebody once said that pessimism is a tool of white oppression, and I think that's true. I think in many ways we are still slaves to the notion that it will never get better. But I think that there is hope, and I think it's important that we celebrate Black joy and Black life, and we remember that change is possible, change is probable, and that there's hope.
That was Isadora Douglas Skinner. You also heard from Alexa and Watson, Haley Rose Watson, Zoe Douglas Skinner, and Douglas Washington Morris II, all of them descendants of Frederick Douglass, reading his speech, "What to a Slave is the 4th of July." Special thanks to my co-host, Rachel Martin, and thanks to all the many talented hosts, reporters, producers, and editors who have worked so hard to tell these stories. You can find more of their reporting on racial justice and much more at npr.org, or you can go right here to your local member station. I'm Elsa Chang. This is NPR News.